Thank you very much. Just have a seat. This case is called Rudder versus People. May I have the issue of appearances, please?
Eric Samuel, can you raise your hand, please?
Thank you, Mr. Sam.
Chris Allen, registration number 23155, on behalf of the people.
All right, thank you, Ms. Allen. This council case is set for 30 minutes only, 15 minutes aside. So obviously, you'll need to keep track of your own time if you wish to reserve some. Go ahead, whenever you're ready, Mr. Sam.
Thank you. Good morning. Mr. Rudder was convicted of one count each of manufacturing controlled substance, methamphetamine, possessing chemical supplies or equipment intended to manufacture a controlled substance, methamphetamine, possessing a controlled substance, and possessing drug paraphernalia. The amount of methamphetamine found on the premises was less than half a gram. The amount of precursors on the premises was enough to make perhaps 11 grams. He was also convicted of three controlled offender counts for the following prior convictions: use of a controlled substance, which occurred in 2001, possession of a serious amount of controlled substance, which occurred in 2001, and possession with intent to distribute a degree with 6.5 grams of methamphetamine that occurred in 2003. Due to the prior drug offenses, he was charged as a special offender, and therefore the manufacturing count, possession of chemicals equipment counts were charged as class 2 felonies rather than class 3 felonies, with sentencing ranges of 8 to 24 years rather than 4 to 8 years. Possession was at that time a class 4 felony with a sentencing range of 2 to 6. Because of the habitual offender counts, the mandatory sentences for the class 2 felonies were 96 years, 4 times the maximum prison range. The mandatory sentence for the class 4 felony was 24 years. The court ran all those sentences concurrent. The Court of Appeals has merged possession of chemicals, possession of methamphetamine in the manufacturing count, leaving one conviction for manufacturing methamphetamine. Mr. Rudder's first parole eligibility date as of today is October 2055. He will be 72 years old. His current mandatory release date is 2103, when he would be 120. Thus, for all intents and purposes, he has received a life sentence. Mr. Rudder was sentenced in this case in March or April of 2010. During that same legislative session that was occurring while he was being sentenced, one of the prior convictions used was decreased from class 6 felony to class 1 misdemeanor. During that same legislative session, the penalty for possession of less than 2 grams of controlled substance was decreased from class 4 felony to class 6 felony. In the next legislative session, 2011, the legislature amended the habitual sentencing statutes to prohibit the use of F6 drug offenses for habitual sentencing purposes. In 2012, the legislature further amended the habitual statute so that the drug law conviction cannot be counted as a prior felony if it was not a felony at the time of the commission of the new offense. And then in 2013, the legislature completely revamped drug law sentences. If Mr. Rudder had committed the crime in question after July 1st, 2010, and used the controlled substance would not have qualified as a prior felony, and thus habitual mandatory sentence would have been 72 years. If Mr. Rudder had committed his offense in 2011, neither the prior use nor the prior possession could be used for official purposes, and the sentencing range would be 8 to 24 years. If he had committed the crime after October 2013, under the current sentencing scheme, his sentence for these same crimes would be between 8 and 16 years. Thus, even though the General Assembly, in 4 straight legislative sessions, beginning of the session being held while Mr. Rudder was being sentenced for this crime, was revising downward the sentencing range for drug offenses, it has instructed the courts to focus on the treatment paradigm rather than the incarceration paradigm, wherever possible. Nevertheless, Mr. Rudder continues to serve a sentence of 96 years, for which as of today, he must serve 45 years before even being considered for parole. All for a crime is committed today will result in a maximum sentence of 16 years. The question this court has asked is whether the General Assembly's subsequent reclassification of a crime, an amendment of the habitual criminal steps that made underlying crime inapplicable for purposes of habitual criminal adjudication, is a relevant consideration during an abbreviated proportionary review of habitual sentence. I would argue that not only can the court consider those factors, the court must consider such factors. Failure to do so would defeat the purposes why an abbreviated proportionality review of habitual sentence is required in the first place. This court has recognized that habitual sentencing statutes are by their very nature formulating a formalism. That's because they require a sentence for a specific term of years based not upon the nature of the current crime, nor on the nature of the prior crime, rather a felony classification of the current crime and the number of prior felony convictions. For statutory official sentencing purposes, it's immaterial as to whether the prior crime is a violent felony or a non-violent felony, whether it was crime against a person, crime against property, or here in narcotics crime, gambling offense, fraud, etc.
Okay, so can I just get you to respond to what I think your opposing counsel will argue, which is your suggestion here blurs the line between proportionality and retroactivity, and that's a retroactivity. I'm just saying what their argument is, so they can correct me if I'm wrong, but that there's something to retroactivity, that's a legislative determination, and if you take that into account every time you do a proportionality review, there's no retroactivity determination. Can I get you to respond to that?
Well, we're not talking about retroactivity here. What we're talking about, there's two separate concepts that we're talking about here. We're not talking about whether or not the statute imposed upon Mr. Rutter was statutorily authorized. That's where we get the retroactivity, whether that's retroactive or not, whether or not that statute applies to him. Granted, it doesn't apply. We're not arguing that it does. What's at point here is the entire purpose behind of why we do proportionality review to begin with. What we look at when we do proportionality review, this court has held that proportionality reviews are required, at least an abbreviated one whenever there's official sentence imposed, because the court needs to look at whether or not the crimes in question, not only the crime that was committed, but the prior crimes, are grave and serious. And how does the court determine whether or not those crimes are grave and serious? The grave and seriousness of the crime is determined in part, at least, by how the legislature views the crime, not at the time the crime is committed, but at the time the court's doing the proportionality review. And thus, you need to look at how the legislature views those sentences at that point in time, the time you're doing the review.
Can I ask you a question based on your answer there? Well, where does it come from that the legislature has any effect on whether a crime is grave or serious for purposes of Eighth Amendment analysis?
Well, my argument would be that I don't know if there's a case out there that says you need to look at how the legislature looks at it, but there are case law out there. For example, in Gaskins, I believe it was. I was in Gaskins. Let me get to look at a case. I'm sorry. Where the court said you need to look at how the legislature views the crime and determine whether or not it's grave and serious. So, yes, the people being asked, the court of appeals have held, at least, that the General Assembly's current evaluation of the seriousness of the offense at issue is the factor that can be considered in determining whether a defendant's sentence is grossly disproportionate. And the court of appeals held that in Gaskins. The court of appeals recently held that in Hargrove. The court of appeals recently held that in Patentville as well. And part of that is that the United States Supreme Court has consistently held that in determining whether punishment is cruel and unusual, courts must consider the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a mature society. And a society's evolving standards of decency are expressed through the public policy as determined by society's elected officials. So the legislature has made a determination of whether or not they view, at this point in time, at the time that this court is to do, or any court is to do, the proportionality review, at this current time, it's in that law. We don't make use of the controlled substances to break a serious offense because we're treated as a class one misdemeanor. Nor do we think that possession of a small amount of a controlled substance should be used to triple or quadruple a sentence, as they expressed through their express statement that they do not think it should be used for purposes of controlled substance purposes.
Actually, let me turn around the retroactivity question just a little bit. Since the legislature has made a choice about how to make its amendments applicable and has chosen to not make them applicable to this defendant's situation, would it be running counter to the presumption that the legislature gets to decide punishments and only if the legislature, if a court decides that they're disproportionate according to the, I guess we all follow Kennedy's test now, basically, from Harmelin, that only in that case would the presumption be overcome and therefore we would do something else? And is there some irony in your argument that we should look at what the legislature has done to show that they're presumed to have done something that's improper?
No, I don't think so at all. Because I think that whenever you enact a sentencing statute, you need to have a starting date. And the general rule is that that starting date starts at the point in time that that statute is enacted. Under proportionality analysis, you have a limited number of people who are going to be affected by that. In this case, you have people for a one-year period of time who are going to be affected by whether or not, you know, they get to look at what the legislature is currently doing at that point in time. That individual is being sentenced for a crime of whether or not what the legislature's current penalties are for that crime. So I think if you make it retroactive, where do you make that cutoff date? You make it 2 years, 3 years, 4 years down? Where do you please make the cut? You have to have a point in time where from here on out, statutorily, the sentence is X or Y or whatever. In this case, the sentence would be 6 years.
You're not suggesting the legislature couldn't have said, not only do we want to make this a misdemeanor, but we also want to not allow previous felony convictions to be used for habitual purposes.
Well, they did do that in 2012. Obviously, they did that in 2012 when it went back there. But yes, they could have. But then you get into the point of whether or not the legislature is saying, okay, for these group of people who are pending right now, we're making a law specifically for them. I'm not sure the legislature can do that or really get involved with that whole special legislation realm of things. I think the court's role, as far as doing the proportionality analysis, determining whether or not at the time the sentence is being imposed, a sentence of 96 years, which at this point in time would be a 16-year sentence, and 4 months later would have been a 17-year sentence. You know, I think the court needs to look at that and determine whether or not that sentence is or is not proportional. And I think that you need to take into account how the legislature currently views
drug crimes, at least minor drug crimes. Pretty fast. I realize you're probably trying to save a little bit of time.
That's okay.
We look at the totality. We look at the triggering and the predicates, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And what do you do with the fact that even under your analysis, you're left with two out of the four being per se grave and serious, even under your definition, I would think, the manufacturing and the distribution convictions?
Well, he only has one conviction after the Court of Appeals. He has one conviction.
Well, no, I understand, but I'm talking about the prior as well.
He doesn't have a prior for it. He has a prior for use.
Prior for use, a prior for PCS, and a prior
for... No, a prior for possession.
Right. Prior for possession, and then a prior for distribution.
No, a prior for possession, and then distribution. So he has one.
Right.
He has one.
One prior, and then the manufacturing triggering offense here.
Exactly.
And so my point is that two out of the four that we're examining are still per se...
Exactly, and that is why it was increased from an F3 to an F2. That is why because of that prior offense, he faced 8 to 24 years rather than 4 to 12 years. So if you're focusing on the fact that he has two of them, that is being taken into account in the length of the sentence.
No, but, okay. I think still in assessing whether or not there would be, whether we can find our way to extended proportionality review, we have to look at the fact that two out of the four here are still per se grave and serious, right? And even Judge Taubman, who authored Hargrove, couldn't get on board here, perhaps for that very reason, if I'm understanding things
correctly. Well, I can't speak why Judge Taubman apparently changed his mind 3 months later. I can't speak for that. But what I can speak for the fact is that, yes, if you have two that are not grave and serious, they're not grave and serious for visual sentencing purposes, they can't be used. And then you have one. The legislature made a determination that one prior grave and serious offense doesn't get you the visual sentencing period. We don't even get to, we don't get to triple, you don't get to partner, you don't get to do anything. What you get to do is you get to use that to increase it from an F3 to an F2.
So remand to impose 24 is right. Okay.
If I can reserve whatever little time I have left.
Of course, thanks.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'd briefly like to just go over what the point of habitual offender sentencing is, which I know this court is aware of, but I think it's important when we're talking about grave and serious of these prior felonies, what the point of the prior felonies are, and the trigger felony and all the rest of it. But habitual offender sentencing reflects a public interest in incapacitating and deterring recidivist felons like this defendant. This is a guy who, from almost the moment he turned 18, back in 2001, started committing felonies. He committed two then. He committed one in 2002, which was the possession with intent to distribute. He was sentenced on that in 2003, originally to probation, which he violated, and then he was sentenced to prison. And if you look at the sentencing hearing for this felony, the probation officer testified, and this defendant violated his parole 5 times on that third felony. He was in and out of prison. Every time he was put out on parole, he violated and he went back to prison. The last time he was paroled was March of 2009, and the next month he was arrested for committing this triggering F2 felony. So we're talking about someone that is the poster person for habitual sentencing. We're talking about 4 drug crimes that progressively got worse, all 4 of which were for methamphetamine, which is arguably the worst drug out there. And at a certain point, the legislature has said it is okay to say, we are no longer trying to rehabilitate you. It's time for you to go away for a really long time. And that's why he was sentenced the way he was in this case. And I would submit that here, as Justice Coates, I think you got to, the legislature specifically put in a mechanism for the severity of the offense, of the triggering offense, to be judged by the time, by the standards at the time of the triggering offense. So in this case, all 3 of his prior felonies were felonies for the purposes of the habitual offender statute. And I think that the simple answer to the question that this court posed on certiorari is, you know, whether a court that's conducting a review of proportionality review may consider these reclassifications. I think the simple answer is, yes, you may. But the real question is, what weight do you give that? What weight, as far as the crimes that have been committed, what weight do you give it? And here, I would submit that we don't give it a lot of weight.
Well, who's giving the weight here now? Are we talking about the trial court? Are we talking about an appellate court?
Either court that's doing the abbreviated review, Your Honor.
Okay. Because we get the weight, do we, as an appellate court, do we get the weight?
I think you do, for the purposes of abbreviated review. And if you make that finding of gross disproportionality, then it gets remanded to the trial court to do, obviously, a more in-depth review.
Okay.
Again, I guess my point is that, you know, how often are these things going to make a big difference when courts are conducting abbreviated proportionality reviews? I would say it's going to be rarely, because if they're going to defer to the legislature in what they were considering in making these changes, we owe the legislature every bit as much deference to the fact that they've picked the timing and that the triggering felony is the one that sets the parameters of what we're looking at as far as prior felonies for habitual purposes.
Counsel, if I may interrupt you with it. You're suggesting that we may take into account the subsequent amendments, and I'm trying to unpack a little bit exactly in what fashion. Does that play into the per se grave and serious determination or not?
Well,
in your view?
As this court's aware, per se grave and serious came from you in prior case law, not from the legislature. I mean, I think that it could reflect that possibly those, for some people, and I might throw that out there, for some people, those aren't necessarily as grave and serious an offense as you determined they were in some of your earlier case law. But we're looking at the difference between statutory changes that go to treatment, and we're talking in treatment purposes for low level drug offenders versus recidivists who we don't care about treatment anymore. I mean, I don't mean to sound harsh, but that's not a concern anymore. The concern is locking them away for a really long time because they're habitual offenders. So I think that that's where some of this weighing of what exactly the changes mean, I think it means different things for different felons, for different people. Does that at all answer your question?
No, go ahead.
I just want to say, I mean, how would you want us to articulate that if we're trying to write that? What does that principle sound like in terms of giving guidance to trial courts?
Maybe my follow-up question, Liz, if you don't mind. Even if we were to say that the use and possession convictions here that were used as predicate offenses were not per se grave and serious, what result do you think should occur?
I think that the court, again, what has to look at the fact that the triggering offense was hugely grave and serious, extremely grave and serious, as was one of the prior felonies. And it doesn't change, I guess, Justice Marquez, to answer your question, it doesn't change the overall test, which is we look at all of these in combination. And I think giving a trial court, you know, discretion to weigh these things isn't going to change the overall weighing of whether in combination the sentence ends up being grossly disproportionate to the crimes committed. I have to point out one thing. Whether those lesser felonies are no longer grave and serious doesn't mean they just go away. They're still there. And the fact that they're meth convictions should make a difference as far as how they're looked at in conjunction with the rest of the felonies. The fact that the possession with intent to distribute bumped the triggering offense up to an F2 in no way changes the fact that that is a grave and serious felony for purposes of the habitual offender proceeding. There are two different things. One is, you know, offense specific. The legislature has said, if this crime has been committed before, if it's a second offense, it's an F2 instead of an F3. And that's exactly what happened here because of his previous conviction. Then you look at it in terms of the offender and the fact that he has this prior grave and serious conviction. You don't not look at it because it's been used to bump the triggering offense up to an F2. There's nothing, I don't believe counsel cited any case law for that. If anything, the fact that the legislature has said that, again, it's an F2, demonstrates just how serious it thinks this current offense, this triggering offense is.
Could I take you back a little bit to what I at least understand to be the fundamental question we're looking at here, and that is the effect of a legislative determination with regard to the seriousness of the crime and how that should apply to a constitutional determination of proportionality. Did I understand you right to be answering these questions to say that you believe the legislature's choice to reduce the seriousness of punishment for a crime changes our prior analysis about whether that classification of crime, that kind of crime, is grave or serious?
I don't think it changes the classification, Your Honor. I think the way I'm looking at it is whether it's something that the trial court or whichever court is conducting the abbreviated proportionality review can consider overall in making this determination.
And actually, isn't the point of grave or serious a classification that determines whether an abbreviated review is sufficient or whether an extended review would be required?
Yes.
So are you saying if the legislature has reduced the crime, the level of punishment of a crime, and we have before said that crime is a crime that's grave or serious and therefore permits only in a, requires only an abbreviated review, that changes?
No, I don't think that that's the case. And I want to clarify, I think at one point what this court said, and I apologize if I'm mistaken, or maybe it was the Court of Appeals referring to this court, but if all the crimes are grave and serious, we don't even need to worry about doing any kind of proportionality review because this court has labeled certain things grave and serious. If it brings into question how grave and serious something might be, which then you're entitled to the possibility of an abbreviated proportionality review. But again, I think the question turns on who the defendant is and the combination of the crimes in total. Because you can't just look at it as a crime. You can't just say, it's, you know, now it's a misdemeanor, now it's an F6. You have to look at it in conjunction with the person that you're sentencing.
Counsel, can I just follow up on that? And are you arguing that, I mean, the cert question says, can you take into account the legislative change? And you would say yes to that. It just depends on the circumstances.
I think it's a yes.
So there's no flat, the yes to that question in your view is yes. And then
yes, rarely. I mean, I guess it's too fair.
Okay, you try to write that. I mean, I'm sorry to push you on that, but I'm just trying to figure out your position, which is yes, you can take into account the more recent legislative enactment, but
you have to look at the circumstances to make a difference. I mean, I can think of a couple of examples if you'll indulge me. Like, for instance, if the triggering offense is something that the legislature has subsequently said could no longer be used as in a habitual offender proceeding, but at the time it's okay to use it. And let's say all of the prior felonies have been amended to be misdemeanors, but at the time he committed the triggering offense, they were felonies. So if you're looking at a really harsh sentence, but all of these changes have been made, I think for abbreviated proportionality review, that's something that a court can consider. I don't think it's the deciding factor by any means. I mean,
well, okay, let me try again. So there are rare circumstances, but you have to look at each case and say, but it wouldn't apply to this case. Is that your position?
Absolutely not. It would not apply to this case. I think because looking at it in the totality of what we have, what this defendant did, we've got grave and serious, very grave and serious crimes. And the legislature said in that kind of situation, you know, a long sentence to put someone like Mr. Rudder away for almost his life is okay. And that's the legislature's prerogative.
Thank you.
And this court has no further questions, I would ask that it affirm defendant's conviction and sentence.
Thank you. Mr. Stanley.
Thank you. I think we've gotten way off track. What we're talking about is an abbreviated proportionality review, not an extended proportionality review. In an extended proportionality review, we look at the defendant, the precise crimes, circumstances leading up to those crimes, because there are many factors that, of course, this court does not know, it cannot consider, it has not been before the court at any point in time, you know, such as the fact that when this is involved with suicide at the age of 13 years old. Now, those sort of factors are things that go into the degree of proportionality of whether or not treatment is appropriate in this case. The only thing we're looking at right here in the abbreviated proportionality review is looking at the crimes in the abstract, of whether or not we have this crime of use of controlled substance, of possession of less of a trace amount of controlled substance, of possession of the defendant is certain 6.5 grams of controlled substance, with the crime that was committed at this point in time, of whether or not that is deserving of a 96-year sentence. Whether that is deserving of the same sentence, for example, someone who commits second-degree murder and has three prior violent felonies. That's the only purpose of what we're looking at right here. All those other factors, sure, people can go back there and argue at the district court level whether in an extended proportionality review, 96 years is an appropriate sentence for Mr. Rucker. And then at that same point in time, he can present evidence of why it should not. The only thing before this court right now is whether or not looking at the crimes themselves, whether or not a 96-year sentence for these crimes raises an inference of disproportionality.
All right, thanks very much, Mr. Sandler. We appreciate the argument of both counsel, and the court is in recess.